This is NPR News, and I'm Angela Davis. Thank you for joining us today. Have you heard about Gabby Petito? For most of us, it would be impossible not to have heard of the young woman who went missing while traveling the country with her boyfriend. The national news media jumped on the story and has stayed with it. Some people refer to this phenomenon as missing white woman syndrome. And while the nonstop attention helps with the search for and possible rescue of women like Gabby Petito, it also highlights the large number of missing women of color in this country who do not get any media attention. Data collected by the state shows that about 15% of Minnesota's female missing persons cases every month are American Indian women and girls. So in any given month, from 2012 to 2020, between 27 to 54 Native American women were missing in our state. Minnesota recently established a statewide government office dedicated to addressing missing and murdered Indigenous women. And there is also a task force looking into missing and murdered African American women and girls, and we'll talk about that in an upcoming show. Today, though, we want to talk about missing Indigenous women and the effort to raise awareness and solve this chronic problem. And I want to hear from you, our listeners. Have you lost someone who is Indigenous? Have you tried to find them? What kind of help were you able to get? Do you have questions about the new Office of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives? The phone lines are open. You can call us at 651-227-6000. You can also call 800-242-2828. Tweet me at Angela Davis, NPR. Joining me right now is DFL State Senator Mary Kunish. She is Minnesota's first Indigenous female state senator and a champion of the bill that created this new office. Hello to you, Senator.
Hey, honey, wash day. Good morning.
Good morning. Also on the line, we have Marissa Mayakonda Cummings. She is the president and CEO of Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center. Hi, Marissa.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning to you. And also joining us is Nicole Matthews. She's the executive director of Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition. Good morning to you, Nicole.
Good morning.
So, Senator Kunish, why create an Office of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives now?
Well, it comes, this office and the incorporation of it within our state government came as the result of the task force recommendation. We created a task force to study the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And one of our top priorities coming out of that report was to create a permanent office where we could continue the work that we started and then to build on some of the relationships and the actions that we've already begun within our state and within our state government. One of the most important things we heard from Canada and their MMIW report was to not just put this shelf on, this report on a shelf and leave it. Make sure you have action to go with it, and that's what we did.
And I understand the office will be located in the within the Department of Public Safety, and there's a budget for it, and there are plans to hire full-time staff members. So tell us more about the work they'll be will be doing.
Yep, there will be four employees in that office. We'll have an executive director to begin with, and then build out a staff that will be able to work with the public and with our governmental agencies around actions that we decide need to be done within our state.
And how do you describe the difference that you have seen in media coverage of, missing women, missing men who are Indigenous compared to, you know, other people who are here in Minnesota? What have you seen?
Well, I think historically we certainly are able to acknowledge the fact that our incidences of Native women that go missing or are murdered have not captured the media's attention before this movement of the MMIW movement. And we really brought it to light, and with that we're hoping that more and more reports will be picked up by the media, picked up by the police, and make sure that they're doing and investigating these things with fidelity. I know that within our study of the task force, there were numerous stories from folks that told us about how they had reported a missing person to the police or tried to get the attention of the media, and there was just really little to no interest in that. And that has kind of been the MO over history. You know, it's just another Indian, it's just another girl that went missing, it's just another runaway sort of situation. And so it has been an incredibly unbalanced attention, both by the resources within the community as well as the media.
Nicole, what have you observed in your work with Indigenous families that supports the need for an office like this?
Well, I think what we have seen is, you know, we, to what the senator was just talking about, we have seen very little response. And so oftentimes it is our own families and our own communities that are out looking for our relatives. We are not getting the same level of attention, be it in the media or be it with our systems. And so when one of our relatives goes missing, you know, I would be curious to know how many people can name, you know, some of the names of the missing or missing relatives here in Minnesota. And there are several, and there are several that have been missing for decades, but we don't know who they are. And we also hear stories when a woman is murdered. We have heard stories when we did the listening sessions during our the task force meetings that there were women that were murdered and the family knew they were murdered and the community knew they were murdered, but their death was reported as a suicide. And so really needing more investigation into those things and really just, you know, more responsiveness and more care and concern. I think for Indigenous people in general, there's a high level of invisibility about us. And when people believe that we don't even exist, and then you add, you know, on top of that stereotypes and racism, then they are more dismissive and there's less care and concern about finding us.
Marissa, what do you see as some of the obstacles to improving media coverage of the crises facing Indigenous women?
Acknowledge that the system is working exactly as it was designed to work. These systems are rooted in white supremacy and racism that was in we were designed not to be here right now, right? Through the genocidal policies of the United States. And our women have gone missing and been trafficked since contact. So this is really a historical evolution of our women going missing or being murdered. And oftentimes, just to echo what Nicole said, we hear exposure. And, you know, growing up as a girl, we knew people in the community that went missing. We knew who was murdered. And we knew that there was never any justice or follow-up because there was so much victim blaming. And our lives just really don't matter as much as other lives do. And so I think there's systemic issues that need to be broken down. And that's what I believe this office can have the most effective way of doing that is to really dismantle these systems of racism that in many ways impact the daily lives of our people.
And do you have a personal connection to this, Marissa? Have you known of people that have gone missing or who have been discovered and they were killed?
I do. There was a woman in our community on our reservation, and I want to say it was about 2 years ago, who was murdered by her partner and found, it was really cold, found in the cornfield. She was reported to police to be missing by her family. They had reported the violence that she endured on a very regular basis, and the police didn't follow up, and that was the tribal police. And then when she was found, the FBI investigated because it was on tribal land, and they found that she was intoxicated and died of exposure. And at the funeral, to see where her nails, where she was trying to survive, right? Her nails were broken off. There was deep bruising on her body. And her mother and her family have been doing everything they can to further an investigation, and yet it's just not going anywhere. And I know that recently the children, because the father who committed this crime was not found to have committed the crime, he got his children back. So there's, you know, yes, it, I know people, I get contacted even from home, and people are asking, like, have you seen my dad? Have you seen my sister? Can you try and find them in Minneapolis? And that's, it's really tough. We have to work with our street outreach workers. We try and get pictures, share it on social media, but the systems are really not designed in a way that we have a fluid, successful way of or mechanism in place to find our relatives. It's usually us doing the groundwork.
I want to step back and ask all three of you about the high rate of violence against Indigenous women and girls, and what accounts for this. And Senator Gunesh, is there anything that you could share with us about this high rate of violence?
Well, I think we really have to go back and look at the history of our nation and the oppression of our American Indian communities. Just like Marissa mentioned, you know, from the moment of contact by Europeans, women and children were sexualized, they were tortured, they were used and abused and thrown away. And that sort of mindset has perpetuated through the hundreds of years, through the generational trauma that our Native American communities experience to this day. So many of our Native folks have kind of, like they said, become invisible because they don't want to be drawing attention to themselves, knowing that they could be an easy target. When our reservations are at such distance from the general population, when there are jurisdictional issues around any kind of crimes or violence, you know, that is another big problem. Is it tribal responsibility? Is it county responsibility? Is it state responsibility? Is it federal responsibility? It is so confusing that the whole thing just sort of drops off because nobody quite knows who's responsible or who wants to take responsibility for investigating these things. And so what happens is that we just kind of get tucked away somewhere and ignored because it's been easier in the past just to let it go than to have to do the work to address the lack of resources in those communities, but also recognizing the vulnerability of these women and these families. And so it's just been easier to ignore it. And we just can't do that anymore. It's just not going to, we're not going to let it happen anymore. We're going to keep talking about, we're going to keep telling the stories. We're going to keep demanding justification for looking for these lost loved ones. And not just the ones that go missing right now, but also, you know, these cold cases, these incidences where we know somebody was murdered or, you know, by a victim of violence, and nobody's doing anything about that. And that's part of what this MMIR office is all about. It's to continue to work on these issues and building the collaboration of our public safety and our judicial system, as well as making sure that there are resources for the communities.
I want to remind our listeners, we're talking about the creation of a statewide office, a government office here in Minnesota, dedicated to missing and murdered Indigenous people. And I want to know, have you lost someone who is Indigenous? How have you tried to find them, and how did that go? What kind of help were you able to get? Or do you have questions about this new Office of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives? You can call us at 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. And Marissa, Nicole, I want to ask you this. Your organization, the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition, you've spoken with Indigenous women who've been trafficked into sex work. And so what have you found in that? What do they say?
Yes, thank you. And I think we need to look at the impact of colonization and how, you know, the very real impact for us today. So one of the things that we learned, you know, in our interviews with Native women who've been used in prostitution and trafficking is that there's a very high rate of poverty and homelessness as a direct impact from colonization. So 98% of the women that we interviewed were currently or previously homeless. And there's also a very big impact with child sexual abuse. And, you know, 79% of the women that we interviewed were victims of child sexual abuse by an average of 4 perpetrators. And we're talking, you know, women who were, one woman who was sold by her non-Native father at the age of 4 so he could get a tattoo. And women who, we heard one story of, you know, a woman who said that a sex buyer told her, "I thought we killed all of you." And that really is the level of violence and hatred that that we are encountering on the street. And that is the, you know, what some people are thinking when they see us and when they think about us. And so, you know, all of these pieces are huge risk factors. And, you know, many of the women that we interviewed also had family members who were forcibly removed and sent to boarding schools. And while we don't have forcible removal for boarding schools anymore, in Minnesota, we have some of the highest rates of out-of-home placement of our kids. And many of our kids are being abused in homes that where they're supposed to be safe. And I think we have to look at all of these issues and take all of it into consideration when we look at the impact, the ongoing impact of colonization and how that's showing up with our families and the real harm that it's causing.
Marissa, you're a president of the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center. What have you learned about the high rate of violence against Indigenous women and girls and what accounts for it?
You know, I really just want to echo everything that Nicole said because she is right on point. I think that there has been an erasure of the education about how this country was founded and the United States policies that directly impacted our families and caused incredible amounts of trauma, with the end goal always being access to land. And so when we think about violence towards our women, that started here in Minnesota. If you think of the Dakota removal, you know, and the Ho-Chunk people that were removed from this area and sent to Crow Creek, where they were being raped and sexually, you know, assaulted, that was part of war. War always has a way of dismantling traditional systems that uphold a people, and women are always targeted in warfare. And that is exactly what happened here. And it's not that long ago. We're talking about great-great-grandparents, you know, and for us as Indigenous people, those great-great-grandparents are still very much a part of our life. I can go 11 generations back in my family. And so that trauma is passed down. And then there's another policy that comes out, and that policy also further perpetuates that violence against our people. And so we've gone through this for generations now, and we are not a deficit people. We are a people that were flourishing civilizations, had agricultural knowledge that was unprecedented in the world at the time. We have these beautiful ways of being and healing as a people. And then there were laws that told us that we couldn't practice our ceremonies and our way of life. And our people went into hiding to continue them. Then our people were sent to boarding schools where they experienced violence. And so then all they knew, because they weren't raised by their parents, was that violence when they came out of boarding schools and the trauma that went along with it. So when we think about addiction, when we think about all of these social issues that Native people suffer from today, I just want to be very clear that the root cause of all of that is colonization and violence. And when we address the systems that perpetuate that violence, being a lot of times, you know, the police, the judicial systems, a lot of violence that happens in border towns, we need to look at a really, I think, a very diverse realm of systems in this country and how they impact our children. And the boarding school era did just evolve. It never ended. It evolved into foster care, which we have now. And we know that the Indian Child Welfare Act is under attack, even at the Supreme Court level right now. And the reason the Indian Child Welfare Act was established was to keep Native children in Native homes with their family and their communities, and the importance of that since they were removed and even sold for so long to non-Native families. So that is a trauma in itself for our children. So I just want to say, like, you know, the attack on our ways of life are not ending. They're still happening, and we're still fighting. But it's overwhelming at times.
Senator Kunesh, what happens now, like when an Indigenous woman goes missing in Minnesota? Where can her family and friends turn? What tends to be the first thing that they do?
Well, I believe the first thing that they do is try to work within the community to find out any information and any facts. But, of course, they ought to be going to either their reservation police or their local police to report this person missing. And it's really up to those local police to decide and to take action immediately. When we look at the kind of action that was taken for Gabby Petito, and of course I'm very sorry and sad to hear her story as well, but that is not, that's nothing I haven't already heard from our Indigenous communities. So they ought to be contacting their local police, and the police will then decide the jurisdictional issues and where to begin that report or the investigation. But again, time and time again, it has ended right there, where it's not investigated with fidelity. The family is not met with respect, or are believed that the person has gone missing. You know, we heard it time and time again. Oh, they ran away, or they're off with their boyfriend, or maybe they went on vacation. There was one investigation, JoJo Boswell, where the police told her we have better things to do than to look for an Indian woman. And so,
that was said to the family?
Yeah, yeah. And so, we need to be sure that our jurisdictional entities recognize their responsibility and are willing to do that within that community. I know that there's a young woman up in Duluth that's been missing, oh, I don't know, for about 4 years, Sheila Sinclair. And for 4 years, her family does not have the information that they need to bring the person that either killed their loved one or knows what happened to their loved one. She was missing, and there's, you know, I would say there hasn't been enough of an effort to really find out what happened. Somebody in those communities knows what happens, and oftentimes they're afraid to speak up, or they themselves are party to the event. And so part of this MMIR office that we're putting together, hopefully we will have some kind of a system that will be able to provide incentive to share information within the community, so a little bit of a reward system, and help folks realize that they need to be part of this whole effort to alleviate all these missing and murdered women and girls that continue to happen. It's a community responsibility. And I think getting back to our original conversation, I think it's also the responsibility of the media. You know, these stories are kind of flash in the pan, and then when things don't move or there isn't a lot of exciting drama going on, they drop the interest or the publicity around these missing folks. And so we do need the media to partner with us. So many of our Indigenous folks go right to social media because that's the quickest, easiest, broadest way to share the missing or the events that are happening within the community when it comes to losing a loved one. And so it has to be a full concerted effort. It's not just one entity's responsibility, but it's all of ours.
And Nicole, what is your understanding of you know, the steps that family members take when they suspect someone's missing, they're worried someone is in danger. What tends to be the first steps they take, and then what happens after that?
You know, I think I would like to say that, you know, the first step would be to call law enforcement. But sadly, we know that it hasn't always been a friendly place. And so, I do believe families are still contacting law enforcement. I most often see social media posts immediately. And we have, you know, several sites on social media and several people on social media who are really pushing this out in the community. And we have grassroots people who are showing up in community and doing searches for family members. So, you know, I think with this office, we can create some accountability for these systems to show up in ways that are meaningful, in ways that are helpful for the families and the communities. And also some accountability in reporting and looking at the deaths of our relatives. I wanted to just, you know, one of the things that, you know, we mentioned when we were talking about deaths was, you know, they're sometimes classified as suicides or something other than what the community and the family knows is going on. And the Minnesota Department of Health has really stepped up to try and do something different and are now starting to conduct what they're calling psychological autopsies to be able to dig a little deeper into the history, into the community, into what really happened rather than just doing their medical examination and then dismissing it as, you know, a suicide or this. And I think that really helps. And the more we can get these systems to show up in ways that are helpful and to be accountable, the more our families and our communities can rely on them and can depend on them and can call them for support when something like this happens.
And Marissa, anything that you've seen that, you know, any advice you would offer to an Indigenous family if they're looking for a relative who has gone missing?
Yeah, I think that I do want to point out that we do have a system in place at MIWRC. We work a lot with unsheltered relatives of the community in the Phillips neighborhood on the south side of Minneapolis. And we developed basically like a protocol of what we do when someone reports a relative that's missing. And so we have outreach workers that are in encampments where they can keep their eyes out and see if, you know, their relatives are in the encampments that are in the neighborhood. But we have advocates, and I know that MUSAC also does Nicole's program. And so I think it's really important that people come to those organizations where they have advocates that can help walk them through the process, because families are so they're grieving, they're traumatized, they're going through a really hard time, and it just helps to have somebody that knows the systems at play and that can help them walk through that process in a productive way.
We're talking about the creation of a state government office here in Minnesota dedicated to missing and murdered Indigenous people. And to our listeners, you can join the conversation. I want to know if you have lost someone who is Indigenous. Have you tried to find them? What was that experience like? What kind of help were you able to get? Do you have questions about this new office of missing and murdered Indigenous relatives? You can call us at 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. You can also tweet me at Angela Davis NPR. We're going to continue talking with our three guests about the creation of this office. And we're also, after the news break, we're going to dig into something else. We're going to dig into this phenomenon known as missing white woman syndrome with another guest, a professor. I'm going to talk to her after the break. First, though, let's check in with Phil Picardi to see what's going on in the news. Yes, that is 1A next at 10 a.m. here on NPR News. And then at 11 this morning, be sure to tune in for a discussion from the Aspen Ideas Festival featuring two Minnesotans. It's called Black and Blue, When a Coach is Also a Cop, and features Charles Adams, a football coach at North High School in Minneapolis, and Zach Yeager, a graduate of North High and now a football player at North Carolina A&T State University. That's at 11 this morning here on NPR News. Now, tomorrow morning at 9, I'm talking about healthcare workers suffering from burnout and the current labor shortage. As the Delta variant continues to raise the number of hospitalizations, what can be done to keep healthcare workers in their jobs? I have some nurses and doctors joining me as guests tomorrow, and I'm hoping more will call in to tell us how they're doing. That's tomorrow morning at 9. And be sure to check us out Wednesday at noon. I will be moderating our latest In Focus event. I have a conversation coming up with parents, teachers, and advocates, education advocates, about navigating this transition back to in-person learning and how we can work together to address Minnesota's disparities in educational outcomes. You can sign up to be a part of that virtual discussion at nprevents.org.
Programming is supported by Little Moments Count, helping raise public awareness and inspiring action about early childhood brain development among parents to ensure a strong start and a bright future for all babies. LittleMomentsCount.org.
Now, back to our conversation about missing and murdered Indigenous women. We're joined by State Senator Mary Kunish, who is the person who championed the bill that recently established Minnesota's Office of Murdered and Missing Indigenous Relatives. Also on the line, we have Marissa Mayakonda Cummings, the president and CEO of Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center. And Nicole Matthews is with us, too. She's the executive director of Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition. And right now, we can bring in another guest. Joining us right now is Andrea Figueroa Caballero, an assistant professor of media and diversity at the University of Missouri. Thanks for joining us, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been listening to this discussion, and I want to bring in yet a new topic. We've kind of talked about it a little bit. I want you to unpack for us what is known as missing white woman syndrome. And if I'm correct, I believe it was the late Gwen Ifill, who was a PBS news anchor and correspondent, who coined that phrase.
Yeah, you are correct. Gwen Ifill coined the term to describe what she saw as the media's extensive and obsessive coverage of white upper middle class women and girls who have gone missing. Since then, kind of the term's been used to point out what appear to be kind of drastic differences in how much media coverage is devoted to white women who have been abducted versus everyone else, but especially women of color who have gone missing.
And have you seen this in your own studies and observations, Professor?
So the limited amount of academic research that does exist on this does support this idea that studies have found that white missing persons are significantly overrepresented in media coverage and victims of color are significantly underrepresented.
And so what is it in our media culture that has led us to this place where a young woman like Gabby Petito can dominate the news?
A lot. There are a number of factors, some of which are unique to Gabby Petito's case, I think, but the majority of which aren't. So I think it's important to note that people, human beings, have always been interested in crime, whether it's fictional or true crime. We have a kind of a natural inclination to seek out information about things that we think are going to cause us harm, regardless of whether that harm is real or mediated or not. Our brains don't really know the difference. So that's why there's this kind of inherent draw towards crime content. In the case of true crime specifically, for the past few decades, kind of since the O.J. Simpson trial, the media environment has just developed more avenues for people to access information about these cases. So first it was the 24-hour news cycle, and then the rise of more curated content like true crime podcasts, and then the advent of social media allowed a lot of things. But for example, victims' families to have kind of direct contact with the public vice versa, kind of providing a different kind of access than before. And I think some of your guests mentioned this at the top of the show, which is we see a lot of the families of missing women of color relying on social media because traditional media outlets aren't giving their case any attention.
Can you give us some insight of what may be happening in newsrooms and that decision-making process and who's making decisions about what to cover and what not to?
Yeah. So when news organizations or journalists are pressed on this issue, they they give kind of a straightforward and pretty unsatisfying answer. And it's that their research shows that their audiences are less interested in hearing those stories, and they're more interested in hearing stories featuring young, attractive white female victims.
So they're saying they're giving the audience what they want?
Yeah.
To some degree?
And to a degree. Mm-hmm. And academic researchers have kind of dug into that a little bit and theorized as to why that preference might exist. And kind of coalesce around the idea that a higher premium is placed on the lives of white women than women of color. So white women are perceived as being easier for most audiences to identify with or care about. And consequently, they deserve more of our attention than missing women of color.
And you mentioned earlier, you said something that there were things that were unique about the Gabby Petito case.
Yeah.
What is unique there?
Well, so as I mentioned, there's already this kind of big information machine that was in place before Gabby Petito went missing. But if you'll notice, a lot of that content and those platforms tend to skew older, right? Like, there aren't a lot of 13-year-olds sitting at home watching HLN, I don't think. So what we saw in this case was that younger people also became fascinated and started creating their own content on platforms such as TikTok, either just posting about the case or proposing their own theories about what happened. And Gabby's is a somewhat unique case in addition to that is because she was a blogger. Her life was already on social media. Mm-hmm. So it was already very public and very well documented. So that added yet another source of information for followers of the case to latch onto. So basically, one of the reasons that Gabby's case is so omnipresent is because it was kind of capturing all of these areas of this media environment in a way that I don't think we've seen before.
So, Professor Figueroa Caballero, is there a good example of a media outlet not falling prey to this white woman syndrome, but still covering, you know, the issue?
You know, that's a hard question because I'm not exactly sure what good looks like in this context. I will say that I think true crime podcasts as a medium or a genre get a bad rap when I think a pretty strong case can be made that they're actually pretty well suited to cover these cases in a way that traditional media cannot.
So in your opinion, how does the media do a better job of covering missing persons in, I guess, a more equitable way? I mean, there are so many cases nationally or even locally, so it's not possible to cover every case. So what do you see as a solution to this?
Well, I think the most practical solution and the way that we kind of can affect change on a broader scale is to fix the racial disparities in newsrooms, which I'm sure I don't need to tell you, Angela, is pretty egregious.
Mm. It is nationally and here in Minnesota.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and this can happen by hiring journalists of color but more importantly, kind of supporting them both with money and anti-racist work environments, which, you know, involves putting people of color in leadership positions within the newsroom. This can also happen by news organizations not simply using the excuse that there aren't enough journalists of color to hire and donating to support organizations like the National Association for Hispanic Journalists or the National Association for Black Journalists who work and provide access and opportunities to aspiring journalism students so then these news organizations can hire them. I'm not saying that this is going to solve the issue. But I think it's kind of the clearest, most tangible way to mitigate so many of the issues we see with racially biased news coverage. And, you know, what we've talked about today is really just the tip of the iceberg.
So you teach there at the University of Missouri. You're an assistant professor of media and diversity. Are you having these conversations in class with aspiring journalists?
I do talk a lot to my students about being savvy media consumers. And, you know, I talk a lot about kind of media literacy and digital literacy and being careful to not necessarily believe everything that you come across on online or in the news. And I think that from an audience perspective, that's something that we can do, right? We can teach our students to become better media consumers and not necessarily kind of rely on some of the problematic stereotypes that are put forth in this type of coverage.
Senator Kunesh, as we listen to Andrea Figueroa Caballero talk about what's happening in newsrooms and within media, what are your thoughts about what she just had to say?
Well, excuse me. I would say she's spot on, especially when we look at who is in those media rooms and who is making the decisions on the different stories that are being publicized at such extent. And it's just really vital that we recognize that there is a disparity between which stories get told and the empathy and the tone that these stories are told in. As we talk about MMIW, and I was thinking as we're talking here this morning, we paint a picture of our Native women and our Native communities being victims, and they definitely have over the hundreds of years here in the United States. But we also have thriving communities. We have more and more Native leadership across the nation, as well as here in Minnesota. And it is those voices that are really coming through when we are building legislation or policies that are going to address these injustices. And so I really appreciate the fact that you're having this discussion this morning and bringing awareness to the fact that we've created a Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives Office, because it will also bring legitimacy to this whole issue. You know, originally when I began creating this legislation, I reached out to the community and to other folks such as Marissa and Nicole, who work, you know, boots on the ground with these issues. But we also had a number of folks that just sort of poo-pooed the idea and said, well, is that even really a thing? Is that really happening? You know, where are the numbers? What is the data on these? And unfortunately, we didn't have numbers. We didn't have a lot of data because it wasn't, you know, historically, the numbers just weren't counted. They weren't recorded with fidelity. And so we don't want to be victims or seen, you know, across the board as victims. But as we are building leadership and championing our communities, but bringing to the media and bringing to the general public the understanding of this historical trauma. I'm an educator, just retired after 25 years myself, and I feel like the biggest part of my job as a legislator is educating people on issues such as this. And so when we look at the role of the media, when we look at the role of social media and postings, you know, it's not just reporting these tragedies, but also lifting up our communities and educating the public around, you know, the cause and effect. Why are these things happening? Well, we were displaced from our lands. We were relocated off of reservations when that didn't work. Our kids were taken from us and sent to boarding school where many of them never returned, and families were disconnected because of that emotional tragedy. These are all consequences for the issues that we have here at hand. And so, again, one of the role of the media is to also uplift the great things that are going on, but also to help us educate folks around these issues. And again, it's not just our Native American women and girls and Two-Spirit that this happened to. You mentioned early on that we We also have just created a task force to study the missing and murdered black women here in Minnesota. So it's having that rippling effect that I had hoped it would long ago, but this really has to be a concerted effort between communities, between families, between media, and folks opening their minds and really understanding what has led to all of this.
And it's my understanding it's Representative Ruth Richardson who is working on that task force to address missing black women and girls as well. Marissa,
yes, she carried it in the House and I carried it here in the Senate.
You guys are holding it down over there for us.
We are.
Marissa and Nicole, I want to get your reaction to listening to our professor who's joining us from the University of Missouri, Andrea Figueroa Caballera. What are your thoughts on the role the media has played and just where we are right now and how we view and value Indigenous family members? Marissa?
Yeah, so when she was talking, I was thinking of my father. My late father was the first Native American journalist in the state of Iowa. And a lot of the reason he went into journalism and then TV and then to public relations was because he knew that our voices were not heard and were dismissed. And on so many levels of systemic racism, whether it be in hospitals when we when we're seeking out health care, whether it be, you know, when we're seeking out media attention, a lot of times our relatives don't know the processes or the systems and how they work. And so having people that are willing to listen to our stories, and then also having, like I said before, advocates or a place that someone can go where they know that they don't have to take the burden. The family that's going through the trauma of having a missing relative doesn't have to take the burden of contacting the media. Because we all know, like, press releases are hard to write sometimes. Mm-hmm. Contacting the media, how do you even do that? You know, a lot of people don't know how to do those things. And so having advocates that are there to support people and help them navigate these processes through a time of trauma is essential.
And Nicole, your thoughts about the role the media has played in where we are today?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think representation really does matter. And having people from within our community who are represented in media and also in positions of power, because even if we have people representing our communities in media, if we don't have people representing our communities in positions of power, we still can't make change because we aren't the decision makers. And I think I have seen more coverage in the last 5 years, and that's really wonderful to see more coverage. And I think we have a long ways to go. And really, it's about how are we addressing the systems of white supremacy that live within every structure that has been built in this country, because it lives and breathes in all of our systems. And that's really what needs to be dismantled and addressed when we're looking at this issue.
And Professor Figueroa Caballero, in our last 30 seconds here, do you think we're at a turning point right now in maybe doing things differently in newsrooms or just giving more thought to how we're covering these cases of missing persons?
I think we're certainly on the right trajectory, and we have been for a while. I don't know if the Gabby Petito case is necessarily, going to speed up that process in any way. But I know from my personal experience that I've seen a lot more coverage of the problematic nature of how missing persons are covered in the media, mm-hmm. Than I have in the past. So
That's
hope so.
Progress. Yes.
Yeah.
We're talking about it, thinking about it, analyzing it. All right. Well, I want to thank all four of our guests for a conversation I found very enlightening. Thank you so much for your time. State Senator Mary Kunish, Professor Andrea Figueroa Caballero there at the University of Missouri, Marissa Mayakonda Cummings, President and CEO of the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center, and Nicole Matthews, the Executive Director of Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition. Thank all of you for your time and the work that you are doing. This conversation was produced by our senior producer, Susan Davis. Be safe, everyone, and I'll talk to you tomorrow morning at 9.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by the law firm of Dorsey & Whitney, Worldwise and business-wise lawyers dedicated to delivering a competitive advantage to clients around the world. More information online at dorsey.com.